Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3040, United States of America versus Vincent Gales, appellant. Mr. Ree for the appellant, Mr. Ambrosino for the appellee.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Ree. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Vincent Gales. The issue on this appeal is whether the district court was wrong to deny Mr. Gales relief under the safety valve sentencing provision because it concluded solely on the basis of his factual proffer that he had failed to disclose the identity of his drug supplier. Mr. Gales believes that the...
As I understand from the record, the judge said he was going to resolve it on the basis of a proffer, and there was not an objection to that choice.
That is correct.
And I don't understand you to be raising that aspect of the decision as an error.
No, Your Honor, we don't think it was an error for the court to proceed that way.
Okay.
Our issue with what the district court did is on the basis of the record that it had before it, we believed it reached the wrong conclusion.
What's the standard for reviewing that?
The standard for reviewing the judge's determination?
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, normally factual issues, of course, are reviewed for clear error. Questions of law are reviewed de novo.
Right.
In this case, the court obviously did not take any evidence and did not make a credibility determination.
However, review of factual determinations is nonetheless under the clear error standard, whether it is oral or other testimony, is it not?
Well, that is correct, Your Honor, but I think this case is more akin to a summary judgment proceeding where the court, on the basis of the evidence that is proffered to him, that's put before him, the court makes a determination that no reasonable person could possibly believe that one side is correct or the other side is correct. And that is obviously a determination that this court reviews de novo. One of the things I'd emphasize for the court is we believe that the court's ultimate determination was not only incorrect, but it applied the incorrect legal standard. And obviously, to the extent that the court was using a faulty standard, this court has de novo review over that aspect of the court's decision.
Where do you find the standard the district court applied?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, you find it in what things the judge said or wrote, obviously. But where specifically, what do you think was the standard he applied?
Well, Your Honor, I think the standard that he applied is not merely that Mr. Gales had to prove that he told the truth, but that he had to essentially overcome whatever doubts that the government had. And the court below actually acknowledged that so long as the government is opposed to relief in this instance, that he wasn't even sure how a defendant could ever overcome that burden, could ever essentially prove a negative, not merely that he had truthfully disclosed to the government what it knew to be true, but that he wasn't telling a lie. In other words, he had to prove the negative as opposed to proving that he had truthfully disclosed to the government.
You said the district court didn't make a credibility determination, but didn't as a practical matter?
Well, it made a determination on the face of the proffer, Your Honor, and what the court concluded is that it was inherently incredible that Mr. Gales would not know the last name or the address of his drug supplier.
Somebody that he said he had known for 10 years and worked on dirt bikes with and gone riding dirt bike with, and he did not know anything about him in the way of identifying Donna. Does that sound credible?
Well,
you don't have to answer that.
Well, I will answer that, Your Honor.
It's clearly erroneous to say that does not sound credible.
I'd be happy to answer that question, Your Honor. Obviously, if he didn't know anything about this person, I think it would be incredible. In this case, Mr. Gales provided the government with quite a lot of identifying information.
He was average height, about average color, average weight, kind of normal looking.
Well, he described
That's the Donna he provided.
He didn't use those terms, Your Honor. He actually said
he's
6 foot tall. He's got a moderate build, a medium complexion. But he also described the hairstyle, the distinctive jewelry that the drug supplier.
What was the hairstyle he described?
Dreadlocks, Your Honor. The distinctive jewelry that he wore, which was a very large pendant that said Jesus, which was half red diamonds and half white diamonds, which I would submit is not something that one sees every day on the street.
Well, was there any corroboration for that?
For that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't believe the government has ever attempted to corroborate Mr. Gales' story.
Did your client produce any corroboration?
No, Your Honor. We don't think we ever got to that point in the proceeding where Mr. Gales would have been in a position to do that.
What position would he have to be in when the cops are saying, I don't believe you? And he says, look, you can ask anybody down there around such and such a place. Isn't there a guy with dreadlocks who hangs out who wears this odd-looking pendant of Jesus? What position was he not in that he couldn't say that?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the government asserted that it had talked to all sorts of people in the neighborhood and that it knew for a fact that Mr. Gales was not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the hearing...
he came up with no response to that in the way of saying, well, go down to the convenience store where he buys coffee. They'll tell you about this guy that comes in with dreadlocks in the pennant. Did he do that?
Well, he actually, Your Honor, he did tell the police. He did tell the police in his debriefing hearing. He told them exactly where Mr. Gales was known to congregate, as
he
well as
in the park sometimes.
Well, the park by Call Street, within two or three blocks of Call Street. I mean, he gave as detailed information as he could. Mr. Gales did not meet his supplier in that location. He met his supplier in his own house. So obviously. That was the nature of their transactions. I understand this court may entertain some doubts as to what Mr. Gales asserted, but we would argue that the standard that the court should have applied is that it cannot dismiss a proffer out of hand and on its face unless that proffer is so unbelievable, so contrary to the teachings of human experience.
So what do you say the court should have done?
Oh, I believe in this case, Your Honor, what the court should have done is they should have turned to the government and said, well, you've asserted that you know that he's not telling the truth.
We
can you
know
proffer?
The safety valve is not the norm. The defendant has to, it has to be established that the defendant is entitled to the safety valve. That's, in fact, a very unusual thing. So you're saying the government has to disprove the entitlement of a defendant to the safety valve?
Oh, not at all, Your Honor. The burden of proof clearly rests with the defendant. What I'm saying is when the defendant...
That said, what should the court have done once the proffer is there and the court does not find it credible? What would cure the error here for the court to have done?
Your Honor, I actually think we agree on the point of law, which is if this was an inherently incredible proffer, I agree that the court would have been right to dismiss Mr. Gales's petition without any further consideration. I do believe the court
isn't
made...
Isn't that essentially what the district court found with a great deal of other discussion, to be sure, but essentially didn't it find that?
Well, yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely what it found. And what I would assert is that the law...
That finding is reversible by us.
It is reversible by you, Your Honor. And again, this is not a decision where he looked into the eyes of the witness and actually took testimony. This is a decision where he made a judgment based on a proffer, which, of course, this court is perfectly capable of doing as well.
I mean, you explicitly invoke the First Circuit at page 14 of your brief.
Yes.
When a defendant in her submissions credibly demonstrates that she has provided the government with all the information she reasonably was expected to possess, the government must at least come forward with some sound reason to suggest otherwise. And I guess it seems to me applying that, why does application of that test not lead to affirmance here?
Well, I'd like to turn to that question, Your Honor, because I respectfully disagree. I think that, again, the threshold being, was it so unbelievable on its face? Was it so contrary to the teachings of human experience that no reasonable person could believe he was telling the truth?
Well, and you make it sound sort of more extraordinary, perhaps, than is necessary. In the First Circuit formulation, all the information she reasonably was expected to possess.
Correct.
I read the district court here as finding that he revealed less than all the information he reasonably was expected to possess.
That is certainly what the district court held. I'd like to turn to that question because the things that troubled the district court were essentially two facts, that Mr. Gales did not know the last name and did not have an address for his drug supplier. And we would submit that in the drug trade, these are quite common occurrences. In fact, we have cited authority for that proposition. And I would ask you not only to take the word of the authority we've cited, but the government in other drug cases has actually taken that position. In certain cases, it has put on expert testimony to the effect that it is expected that an individual in the drug trade, even people who've been dealing with each other for years, might not know their identity. I'd refer this court to a decision out of the Second Circuit, United States versus Cruz. With the court's indulgence, this is the testimony of a government expert witness. Most of the time, the people involved, even though they have been dealing this way for a number of months, even years, will not actually know the other individual's identity. They may know each other under pseudonames or street names like Gotko or Sneakers or Curly. This is so they can better insulate themselves from arrest. This is a government expert witness that offered this testimony. And in this case, the same government, the Justice Department, is taking the position that it is facially implausible for Mr. Gales to make that exact same point. And what we would assert, Your Honor, is that it is certainly plausible. It is certainly meets this threshold. And what the court should have done in this case is at least turn to the government and said, well, why don't you tell me what proffer what evidence you have so that we can decide whether or not we should
proceed. Didn't both sides make a proffer?
Well, the government's proffer, Your Honor, did not go into any details as to their information that they had about this other drug supplier. They did not proffer any witness whatsoever who would say that Mr. Gales got his drugs, whether a neighbor or his girlfriend or someone else.
Do you think the error lies in the proposition that the government's proffer was not detailed enough?
Well,
I
believe
what makes this clear error?
I believe the government didn't. All the government proffered was that they did not believe Mr. Gales. They didn't actually proffer any evidence that supported that position.
All right.
Could you give your view of what the district court was talking about in the passage saying that the defendant faces a Hobson's choice? It's at page 3 of the opinion.
Yes, I think this is evidence, Your Honor, that the district court was really struggling with how to apply the standard here.
That's true, but I'm asking right. What cognitively he meant by this.
Oh, I think what he decided, Your Honor, was that in his mind, it was very difficult to reconcile the safety valve provision here with the separate provision for substantial assistance, and that Mr. Gales, because he decided not to cooperate with the government for the purpose of seeking a substantial assistance reduction, therefore was going to have a very hard time proving that, in fact, he had provided truthful information to the government. And obviously, as we argue in our brief and as the government actually argues in their brief.
Focus on testifying. But the, he could have done something quite different from what might have been required under 5K, have some sort of hearing in camera at which he would testify and subject himself to cross-examination, without perhaps the risks that would be involved in open testimony.
I agree, Your Honor. In this case, the district court announced it, quote, did not want to go that route, and it was not interested in hearing from Mr. Gales.
Didn't your defendant object to sealing of the proceedings in this case? Am I confusing this with another case?
No, Your Honor, he didn't object. Originally, he suggested that he might want the hearing sealed, the safety valve hearing sealed. When it actually came time to have the hearing was open in the public, and he did not object. If there are no other questions from the court, thank you.
All right, well, you've used your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes if necessary for rebuttal. Or we've used your time. Any of your time got used?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Ambrosino for the United States. The district court in this case reasonably concluded that appellant had not met his burden at the safety valve hearing. Importantly, before the court ruled, and we review this, we set this out on page 9 of our pleading, the district court verified with defense counsel that the facts as he understood them were undisputed. And those were that there was a single supplier, that he went by the name of Jake, that he was of standard size, height, clothing, hairstyle, that he had a unique necklace, that the defendant knew him for 10 years, that he had ridden dirt bikes with him, that he did not have any identifying information about his supplier other than this name Jake, and that he did not have his current or former telephone number. And I'm going to get to that because that's actually quite important. That's where this whole proffer really falls apart with the telephone number. That he did not know where Jake lives, and that he could only isolate him by this park, his geographical location. Now, as the court had already observed, As this hearing progressed by way of proffer, the defense did not object to it proceeding, the district court proceeding that way. The that characterization of the evidence, as is set forth on page 9 of our brief, was not objected to by defense counsel. There was never any effort on the part of the defense to call any witnesses or to supplement the record with any other evidence. And the court was well within its discretion at that point in the proceeding, based on those undisputed facts, to decide that it could make a determination based on those undisputed facts. And the court issued an oral ruling from the bench. And then the court went on to issue its written opinion. And in that written opinion, the court not only reiterates those 10 facts that I just set out, but the court makes three observations about the proffer by the defense. The court notes that it was could not be cross-examined because it was done by way of proffer, that it was uncorroborated, and that it was inherently incredible. And it's that point that the district court expands on and really was well within its discretion to conclude. The district court talks about how it simply was not credible that this person did not have more information about somebody he had known for 10 years and did regular business with. Those were the two factors that the court focused on. And the court did so in the context of the manner in which this debriefing took place. And the court specifically focused in on the fact that this was an unusual safety valve applicant. We cite cases, and the defense, appellant also cites cases that talk about the distinction between safety valve eligibility and general cooperation eligibility. And typically, the cases have talked about how Congress enacted the safety valve really for low-level players, such as the one talked about in the Miranda Santiago case that appellant relies so heavily upon, where this woman was a passive conspirator who basically allowed drugs to be stored in her apartment. That's not the case here. This is the case of somebody who readily admitted to the government in his debriefing that he was dealing drugs right up until the time of his arrest. He was the one cooking the drugs in his apartment and routinely dealing them out of his apartment. And the court, rightfully so, focused on the fact that this was an individual who was given an opportunity to cooperate. That is undisputed, but what's also undisputed is that Ms. Lotze made the very point to the district court that her client made a conscientious decision not to cooperate. And the district court assumed, and the district court judge was reasonable to assume this, that that cooperation would have involved giving information about his supplier. That's a reasonable assumption in the context of a drug case. And the judge talked about this at the hearing, and he talks about it in the written opinion, that this was a person who made a conscientious decision not to seek cooperation. And the judge, after that decision was made, Ms. Lotze talked about how it was very hard to get this person to come in to do a debriefing with the United States. Given those circumstances, and given the circumstances also at the end of the process where the safety valve hearing takes place publicly, if Jake really existed, it would have been irresponsible for the defense to allow this to go forward publicly. It was reasonable under these circumstances for the district court to conclude that this was just inherently incredible. And that's the position the government took. The government began the safety valve hearing by saying, we agree the burden is on the defense, and if the defendant wants to get up there and testify, he should, and the court should evaluate that testimony. Now, I want to make one point about the phone. At the debriefing, Mr. Ramos, the prosecutor below, made very clear to the court that at the debriefing, the defendant not only admitted selling drugs out of his apartment, but he was very clear that he sold them up until the time of his arrest. Now, if you look at the sentencing memo, which is attached to appellant's brief, this is an important point. He was not arrested or charged until September of 2007. There was a 9-month time period between the time that the girlfriend was arrested and the time the defendant was arrested. Ms. Lotze, this comes from the defense, I'm relying on the sentencing memo submitted by the defense, not the United States. Ms. Lotze below, defense attorney, said to the court, she said it at the safety valve hearing, and she said it again at sentencing when she tried to reopen this issue before the district court judge. She said that the reason the defendant couldn't remember his own number and couldn't remember the number of Jake was because he threw his phone out when his girlfriend got arrested. Now, there's something very implausible about that, because he admitted dealing drugs up until the time of his arrest 9 months later. How was it that he could have contacted Jake if he had thrown his phone out and didn't know his number? There was never any effort to explain this discrepancy. There's a 9-month period where this person in a wheelchair who's dealing drugs out of his apartment has no means to contact his own supplier.
There's another passage of the district court opinion that I'm not clear of the meaning of. This is at page 5, where he seems to feel there's a great tension between the safety valve rule as understood by this court and 5K. And I'm honestly not sure what the great conflict is there, what the great tension is.
I don't know. I think what the court is asking a rhetorical question there of if what is the point of requiring a defendant to be truthful if the government already has information in its possession that contradicts what they're being told? What is the point of taking away safety valve eligibility to a person in that situation? And the court grappled with that question, but the court also understood the safety valve. And at sentencing, the court talks about it and talks about the decision. And what the court says on page 5 of the sentencing, defense counsel tried to reopen the issue, the district court judge says, look, if you're buying drugs from the same guy for years, you have to know where he is. You have to know where you can find him. What if you get bad drugs? You need some sort of recourse. And he went on to say that he hadn't heard testimony on page 6, that he hadn't heard testimony from the defendant, and that the only way he could evaluate the plausibility of the story was based on the proffer. And he admitted that that was a difficult call to make, but these are his exact words. He said, but my call is that he's not been forthcoming. He has not told the prosecution what he knows about the crime of conviction. He doesn't get the safety valve. So the court did express these concerns about the interplay between cooperation and the safety valve, but the court also understood its obligations, and it did not abdicate its obligation to make a credibility determination based on the undisputed facts. And those, there was no objection to the manner in which the court proceeded, and there was no effort by the defense to supplement those facts. If the court has no other questions.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to briefly touch on a couple points that were raised by the government. First of all, the government is arguing, as they did in their brief, that it was proper for the district court to consider Mr. Gales's non-cooperation under 5K1.1 as a factor in evaluating whether or not he truthfully debriefed with the government. First of all, the government doesn't cite a single case for that proposition, that you can consider the fact that a person did not get a 5K1.1 letter or did not participate in that process.
Is it more the proposition that there's a substantial overlap between not satisfying what would move the government to make a motion under 5K and not satisfying the safety valve? Why does one need a case for this? It's obvious there's an overlap.
Well, there's obviously an overlap. The problem comes in, Your Honor, when you take the fact that a person did not get a 5K1.1 letter and say, well, that's evidence that he's not telling the truth, which is the inference that the government is asking this court to draw. It's the inference that the district court drew below. essentially, if he was really telling the truth, he would have cooperated.
Where does the government say that?
Where does it say it, Your Honor? I believe they took the position just now that it is proper to consider the fact that Mr. Gales consciously chose not to cooperate as evidence that he's not telling the truth with the government. That has been their position. I can cite a page in their brief if you'd like me to do that as well, Your Honor. But I believe that's what...
He may have used that term. It still doesn't seem to me to amount to much more than an observation of the overlap of factual premises.
I think if you're allowed to draw that inference, you do have that tension, which is improper. And I understand the court is concerned about that. The last point I'll make, Your Honor, is with regard to the cell phone. Obviously, he's brought up this new factual discrepancy. This is not even a point that the government addressed in its brief. Suffice it to say that the district court did not rely on this point. This so-called lag between when the defendant said he got rid of the cell phone, and I could go into great detail into the record. I'm sure the court would prefer that I not do that. I think it's easy to dispose of that issue by saying that was not an issue before the court.
Well, let's go a little further, if you would.
Sure.
Because honestly, there's no new issue injected by the government here. It may be a new approach to arguing about the issue, but the issue's there. So. And the record's there. So if you would, tell me why the government's position is incorrect.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I wasn't meaning to be dismissive. The point is, the district court did not make any factual finding whatsoever that Mr. Gales was not being truthful with regards to the cell phone, and that because he got rid of the cell phone...
That it was unreasonable to believe that he had no way of contacting his sole supplier. And this would go to that finding... So why isn't the record supportive of the government's position if the record reflects what the government proposed there?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe the record actually supports, and if I'm happy to go into the details. I don't believe the record...
I know your time's up. I'm using it now, will you?
I don't believe the record actually supports that Mr. Gales told the government that he continued to deal with Jake after the arrest of his girlfriend. In fact, what he told the government... was that he stopped dealing with Jake. Now, the record is very sparse in this case because we didn't take testimony. The court made it clear that it didn't want to hear testimony in this case. So I can't... This is a factual dispute between us and them, perhaps. They will not be able to cite a page in the record where this issue was asserted, and we will not be able to cite a page in the record where it wasn't because we don't have a transcript, obviously, of the debriefing. But I can tell you in speaking to Mr. Gales that he did not tell the government that he continued to deal with Jake after his girlfriend was arrested because, in fact, he got rid of his cell phone and because everyone sort of went underground at that point. Now, he did continue to sell drugs.
He did continue to sell drugs, and he never came forward with another supplier in his proffer. Jake's the only supplier he ever said he had.
Right? Your Honor, actually, I believe that's incorrect. Mr. Gales did tell the government there was another supplier. The issue is it wasn't the supplier they wanted to hear. It wasn't this TJ person, which, by the way, I'll just point out, TJ is a nickname as well. If Mr. Gales had told them the name TJ, apparently they would have been satisfied, notwithstanding the fact that TJ is not even a first name, let alone a last name.
I take it he didn't have the phone at the time of his arrest, because then the government... presumably have it, but did he offer any explanation as to how he got his supplies in the period between throwing away the phone and arrest?
That's what I was trying to ask, yeah.
Well, he did identify a second supplier that he had, Your Honor.
Identify?
Yes. And I can, if you give me one moment, Your Honor, I can find a citation to the record where that is indicated.
More particularity than he identified Jake?
Your Honor, honestly, on this point, I was not representing Mr. Gales below. The government has never contested the identity of that second supplier, so I don't know, frankly, whether that was ever an issue. It certainly has never been an issue in this appeal. And there was an assertion in the record by Ms. Lotze that Mr. Gales had identified a second supplier during the course of his debriefing, and that was never contested. It was never contested by the government. I apologize, Your Honor, I don't have that at my fingertips, but...
Well, Everybody sends us the 34J letter telling us where the material is that refers to any second supplier or what's been done, what was going on between the girlfriend bust and the...
I will do that, Your Honor, and I will also include a citation.
It would not need to be a formal brief. You could just give us a letter in the next five business days.
That's fine. I could do that today, Your Honor. I will also...
Get one of those from each side.
Absolutely. I will cite the case that I referenced earlier where the government offered that expert testimony as well. I realized I didn't provide that to the court. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ree, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance to the system. And thank the United States.